talking with Dave McClure, who's now with the Farms Fund. I actually met Dave like 10 years ago when we were both just doing a little bit of stuff in Silicon Valley, and we had a couple of cool dinners together. And Dave's really taken off out in the Valley. He's like one of the big networking guys. He's on Twitter and Facebook constantly and putting out a lot of interesting content, and is now part of the Founders Fund. So I guess he's turned into a VC. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us, and tell us a little bit what's going on.
Thanks, Aidan. I think I'm probably one of the most dangerous people alive with sharp dueled objects. So the fact that I have any of my money as VC at all is probably a crazy thing, but I'm having a blast.
Cool. So why don't you tell us a little bit about where you came from? I know you had an Asia consulting firm and some of the stuff you've done in the past, and sort of get us to where you're at today.
Right. Well, actually, I was started out as a developer. I guess I came out to Silicon Valley in late 80s, 1989. And started out out here as a database developer and programmer, and then started a company that was an internet and e-commerce company. I guess it started out being more the consulting company I was using to do some work for Intel and Microsoft, and gradually added a few friends to that company, and that became my first venture of sorts, and probably did everything you could possibly do wrong as an initial business owner, but it was a very useful set of lessons, and I surprisingly managed to get a small acquisition that occurred out of that. I guess along the way, I made a transition from being, primarily a developer and engineer into being, sort of a small business owner, and then, I guess, more technology marketing and, to some extent, technology evangelism, I guess we call it now. And that sort of stuck with me. I've really been enjoying kind of being a very extroverted and outgoing geek. I call myself that rather proudly. Subsequent to that, had the great opportunity to be at PayPal for a few years running sort of a developer network program there that was also kind of a technology education and technology marketing function. After that, ran marketing at Simply Hired for a little while, and also became an investor at Simply Hired. And then really, I think over the last 5 years, got more into doing angel investing on a personal basis, somewhat haphazard and then more regular. And I guess about a year ago, started getting to know and talking to the Founders Fund guys, who are some ex-PayPal people I used to work with. And jumped in with them more formally. And so now I've been running a number of different programs, but really sort of running a seed stage investment program for Founders Fund internally. And have been doing both some investments as well as some education and outreach evangelism programs for entrepreneurship that are just really a lot of fun. So I guess that's sort of the last 20 years, a very short order. A couple other things along the way I'm sure we can talk about a little bit as we go forward.
Cool. Well, you're raised one really interesting point. We see it all over the media about the PayPal mafia.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what that actually is and what that means?
Well, first of all, I have to say I'm really just a very low-level henchman in the PayPal mafia. for one reason or another, I'm not exactly sure that I know the whole story here. There's been a disproportionate number of people that have been entrepreneurially focused that came out of PayPal, and so probably most notably, I think, Reid Hoffman, who started LinkedIn, John Karim, Steve Chen, and Chad Hurley, who started YouTube, Jeremy Stoppelman and Russ Simmons, who started Yelp, David Sachs, who has done Genie and Yammer, also, as well has produced some very cool movies. This kind of goes on, I'm sure I'm forgetting one or two other things, but Max Levchin also, who's a co-founder of PayPal along with Peter Thiel. Max ended up founding Slide. Peter Lee, former CEO founder of PayPal, went on to start his own hedge fund, Clarion Capital, and then eventually started Founders Fund as, the private equity side of that, which is where I've ended up. I think that's at least the folks that I remember off the top of my head. Rula Flota also is over at Sequoia, one of the youngest partners at Sequoia. So it's really strange that I get rolled into that group of folks. I have not created a billion-dollar company like many of the other folks, but I think there's many of us who sort of shine in the backdrop of all the rest of those folks who've done great, great things.
Well, but Donald Starr is still rising, so you're on the way up, and they're still coming out of that crowd. Would you not agree with that?
I hope you're absolutely correct, but I certainly know that I get a lot of benefit from the association with all those folks. It's probably not as well deserved as.
I saw a comment on it specifically. I mean, anytime I log into Twitter or on Facebook, it's like Dave McClure all the time, and someone else was like quoting that, and I used to retweet it. It was hilarious. I mean, everywhere you go, there's Dave.
I think it's true. I'm a very outgoing person in the Valley, and I will admit to going to an evening event or two.
I mean, I'm real quick to delete people that aren't interesting. And, I mean, I read all these stuff both on Facebook and on Twitter because you post really interesting stuff.
Well, thank you, Adrian. That's very kind. I must say that I spend a lot of time on those tools, and I'm probably addicted to them in almost three senses of the word. But hopefully I'm not too annoying with all the stuff that I'm doing on there.
Oh, good stuff. With the PayPal guys, aside from Peter, have any of the big shine guys, have any of them done a startup that's not related to viral marketing?
Well, I mean, certainly David Sachs, you know, had a pretty amazing success with Thank You for Smoking, which was a movie that was an
international right, movie.
Right. And I, you know, I don't. Those of us who worked with David internally knew he was, you know, sort of very exacting taskmaster in terms of copy edit for the site, and so seeing him as kind of a movie producer and writer. Or executive producer of sorts. Actually, what
did he actually make a movie? I thought those guys just invested in it and didn't actually do anything.
I mean, I think they probably did invest in it, but I actually think that David probably had a hand here or there in some of the things that happened with that. So, you know, it's hard to say. One of the things that's always interesting is success has many mothers out here in Silicon Valley, or success has many fathers. but, you know, it is really curious. A lot of the businesses were definitely based on some amount of consumer internet focus. In some cases, our marketing, in some cases, you know, search engine optimization. You know, I think there's definitely a couple of different trends that were common to many of those businesses. But probably I think the thing that's just kind of most surprising is you know, the sheer number of people, you know, that came out of PayPal and ended up starting, you know, some form of business that became relatively well known, you know, at least in the
last. Well, but they really saw viral marketing take off at PayPal, and so they went and just each of them went and pushed that. I mean, Slide, viral marketing through Facebook, Yelp with virally driven signups.
I think it was a pretty solid acquisition strategy, you know, for customers for almost all of those. But I would say that, you know, a couple of people learned things about search that wasn't necessarily part of any of the DNA of PayPal. But really, I think the thing that was probably most notable, and I really had a really recent opportunity to talk to Peter about this, was that PayPal was really a crucible of sorts. It was a very challenging environment. There was a lot of people who were, you know, probably not interested in PayPal succeeding, you know, and among them were, you know, other financial institutions, banks, legal entities, eBay at various times. Card associations. I think it was always a very challenging environment, and you know, I think a lot of people use the aphorism that which doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And so, pretty much everybody at PayPal had this, you know, infused into their DNA. They were incredibly paranoid about survival and really trying to just be as focused as they could on surviving. And I think for whatever reason that made a lot of people who came out of PayPal just very focused on how to get things up and off the ground. You know, viral marketing being one of them, but also just being, you know, incredibly conservative and somewhat cheap on customer acquisition strategies. And really, I think understanding just how internet marketing works, you know, which there are
tons of companies. Do you think it's more like a core understanding of internet marketing itself rather than just viral marketing and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, because there's a lot of other companies that have been successful based on, you know, engineering culture. You know, and certainly I would say PayPal was largely an engineering-driven culture, but it was different than, you know, the way Google is about engineers. I mean, I think if there was maybe one thing, I would say that we were, you know, there's a pretty long and interesting series of essays that I think either David Sachs wrote or someone did an interview wrote with him that talked about how he was thinking about customer acquisition. And it just wasn't anything that you'd ever heard, you know, out of either this business-driven culture or an engineering-driven culture, you know, where engineers were sort of focused on, you know, cool features and products, and a typical business organization was focused on sort of, you know, spreadsheets and, you know, graphs and numbers. But when you heard, you know, David talk about things, it was kind of like, okay, how do we get an incremental customer at a very minimal market cost, and then how does that translate into, you know, very, very specific and bare-bones features? And I think a lot of the techniques that people now are starting to associate with very, you know, acquisition-focused startups and nimble, you know, internet marketing, a lot of those ideas I think were things that people were playing with fairly early at PayPal around 2001, 2002 or so.
Yeah, well, I guess we're getting on being almost 10 years later.
It is, yeah, it's been a while now since a lot of that stuff happened, strangely enough.
Do you, I mean, personal opinion, do you think PayPal would be better off if it had stayed independent and had those guys driving forward?
You know, it's really hard to say. There's definitely a couple of factors that drove, you know, the acquisition. You know, one of them was that a large percentage of PayPal's business was happening on eBay Marketplace, you know, probably more than half, probably close to two-thirds at the time. The other thing was there was a reasonable amount of revenue that PayPal was earning from two particular markets, one, the gaming business or gambling business, and the adult services business, shall we say. And those two businesses are one that I think, you know, the U.S. government was not necessarily so interested in seeing online companies perform. So I think PayPal was facing a decision about, you know, how we handle these two, you know, lines of business that, you know, might be high growth and profitable for us but are likely to face a lot of litigation. And then also, you know, just from a relatively nuts and bolts perspective on, you know, any type of acquisition, PayPal was always going to be more valuable to eBay than almost any other company. And so it was relatively difficult to arrange, you know, any type of a competitive acquisition where there was more than one player who had, you know, as large and valued an interest in PayPal. And really what ended up happening was PayPal went public as kind of the, you know, second alternative to Meg Whitman at eBay buying PayPal. And finally, only after going public, you know, and sort of valuing the company that way, was a deal worked out for PayPal to be acquired by eBay. And then as a result of that, they pretty much shed their efforts in adult gaming businesses. And so I certainly think that many people look at PayPal and say, well, if we'd remained independent, we would have been, you know, this huge company that was much bigger than, I think, the billion and a half or so that eBay acquired at. But there was sort of this turning point transition that PayPal would be facing that would be much more challenging, you know, going alone as an independent if they decided to keep those businesses. So I don't know. I think, you know, in hindsight, it's easy to say, well, you know, if they'd taken more, you know, extreme steps and set up in proper ways, you know, PayPal might have been this 10, 20, you know, $50 billion company.
They might not have been tight that. They could have ended up as, like, a small subsidiary of Bank of America.
Right, or they could have litigated off the face of the planet, or they'd have to maybe move to an offshore environment. There's just a lot of large and significant challenges that I think weren't as easy to, you know, maybe navigate with full foresight. And, you know, all things being equal, $1.5 billion payday probably isn't the end of the world.
Yeah, well, as a founder, you're not making as much as a lot of other guys did. But,
yeah. You know, that's true. I think that is one of the smaller, less told stories. It's probably, you know, that due to all the capital that PayPal and initially also X.com had raised, and a couple of had merged, I think, around the 2000 timeframe, that really a lot of the, you know, equity holders were not the founders. They were outside investors. And certainly, you know, it was a great story for all involved, and I think, you know, a lot of people made money. But relatively speaking, I think the founders did not end up with as huge paydays as many other people might have thought based on numbers.
I just wanted to say that because I think guys like Max and the others worked really hard, and they deserve more.
Yeah. Incredibly hard. I mean, that was the other thing, that the culture of PayPal was really, you know, driven to almost an extreme, and it was not unusual at all to see people there, you know, even after the company gone public, to see people working till midnight, and you know, it was fun as well as, you know, burned into the culture that we play hard and work hard and have a lot of people there staying late. But I do think there's maybe an interesting other, you know, footnote to that PayPal Mafia story, which is it may have been that people there, you know, felt like they didn't really get as much of the benefit as they had put into it, or at least that they, you know, maybe left a lot of money on the table for the investors as opposed to themselves, and many of them, you know, kind of wanted to go back and really prove that out, and we're still kind of hungry. So it's possible that because people were so driven and still a little bit hungry after the PayPal, you know, payday, that many of them went on to start their own businesses too.
Oh, right. So that makes sense. So they've seen them all at work. They've seen buyer acquisition. They knew how to get things done. They had contacts. They had a reputation because it was PayPal, and so that, yeah, that makes sense. And so out of that then came a certain little enterprise called the Founders Fund.
Yep, and that was started, I think, probably around 2004. So originally it was a $50 million fund that was a pretty early-stage fund. And then later, a couple years ago, I believe Sean Parker also joined, you know, Ken Howery and Luke Buzik and Peter Thiel out of Facebook. And then they raised a slightly larger fund, about $220 million fund, which is one they've been operating for the last couple of years. And, you know, again, I think Peter has always been, Peter Thiel has always been a pretty amazing person for identifying talent and, you know, both in bringing people into PayPal and in subsequent to that, doing a lot of individual angel investing. And, you know, I guess, you know, Peter, through also Ken and Luke and Sean, those folks have been able to get involved in a lot of really amazing businesses relatively early. And probably, again, I think that skill in viral marketing and internet marketing has been very helpful in both getting them into interesting companies and as well as maybe helping them be successful.
And so one of the tenets of the founders fund, as I understand it, is that they do take it's a founders fund because it's about taking care of founders, making sure they get well compensated for starting up companies. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and you know, again, that may be from feeling that, you know, they didn't necessarily have as much of that you know, opportunity when they were doing their own businesses. But I'd say the main thing that the founders fund tries to distinguish from other companies is that, you know, it's built by people who built their own companies. And so, you know, in particular, there's been a lot of the DNA of three companies, in particular PayPal, Facebook, and Google, that represent a lot of the people on the investment team. And that, you know, those two companies have had a lot of engineering-driven success, a lot of focused founder efforts, and, you know, just not really the most traditional VC approach to investing. I think, you know, at least over the past 10 to 20 years, a lot more of the VC community has come out of the financial services and money management world. And, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, that's just kind of how the business has evolved. And, you know, it's true that both, you know, Peter and PayPal would also cut from that cloth, but I think the one difference that we try to make known is most of the people involved in investing at Founders Fund have been involved in doing their own companies, at least at some size or other.
Why did you join Founders Fund rather than do some of the other stuff you have going on?
Well, to be honest, I was working on raising my own fund at the time last summer when the market went through a relatively significant amount of turmoil. But Sean approached me. I got to know him a little bit through both, you know, the PayPal community as well as the Facebook community. And he, you know, really made me a compelling offer to come in and do some work that I'd been wanting to do, you know, through the vehicle, through the umbrella of the Founders Fund. So I don't think I'd be able to do what I'm doing and the kind of projects that I'm doing at most traditional VC firms in the Valley. And my background, you know, hadn't by any means been a traditional one either. So I think the fact that both I knew people at Founders Fund who had come out of PayPal, they had a very different approach. They were very founder-friendly in terms of how they went after putting businesses together and working with people. And then they're really willing to take a bit of a flyer on me and give me a shot in ways that I think most other VC firms wouldn't have been quite so freewheeling or free-thinking.
How long have you been there?
I've been working on it for 6 months, and it's been a pretty crazy last 6 months. It's been very active last 6 months.
To me, it would seem like, given the amount of just the amount of attention and the network you build out there, it would have been a tremendous catalyst for the Founders Fund. Have you been getting a lot of interest in potential deal flow and all that sort of stuff?
Well, I think it was really a good match. I enjoyed doing a lot of sort of entrepreneurship and education and technology. Cheerleading, I guess, for lack of a better word, along with the investing stuff. I've been doing a number of user groups and conferences for many years, but in the last few years, I've been working with O'Reilly and a few people doing, conferences around internet marketing, around Facebook and social networking platforms, and then around, startup techniques and metrics and analytics. It's a little bit unusual to sort of combine investing with the type of, events and conferences approach that I've been doing. But that was, one of the things that Founders Fund was looking for was this combined sort of role in both entrepreneurial outreach and marketing evangelism, as well as being able to identify, early stage companies that were a little bit earlier than their traditional, Series A type of focus. And so that fit really well. I've been doing, a lot of, startup-related, efforts and mentoring and things over the last 5 years. And really, the chance to have a relatively small amount of capital but a lot of freedom, was a really great way for, I think, me to break into the more, traditional investing world.
And is that your goal now, to become a VC?
Well, I don't know that I'll ever likely end up as John Doerr, and, heaven forbid that I ever am that successful, that would be terrific. I sort of feel like at some point I might still do my own startup again, and that would be fun. But what I really enjoyed is pretty much leaving PayPal even while I was simply hired. I got the chance to invest in a lot of really fun startups, and as a personal angel investor, was in about 12 or 13 deals. And I just really found that I enjoyed that a lot. It was just great working with companies that were sort of between 2 to 10 people. A lot of the challenges they faced in kind of getting off the ground, getting a product out the door, figuring out the online marketing strategy and how they do customer acquisition, maybe starting to get into revenue generating and profit optimization. Those types of exercises were really fun. They were mentally stimulating and challenging. They were based on some things that I think I had a little bit of experience in, and for better or for worse, that made it easy for me to get involved as an investor with helping them solve some of the product marketing problems. After doing that, kind of in an amateur profession on the side for the last 3 or 4 years, I just found like, I really was less interested in going back into my own startup and more interested in helping additional startups. And so probably about a year and a half ago, I started thinking about how I could do that on a more regular basis. Initially I'd been looking at doing my own fund, and then the opportunity with Founders Fund came along and really ended up being a great fit.
People listening to the interview or reading this, they're going to be interested in, I want to know, like, how they get funded. How do they get funded?
Yeah. Well, it's true, and I try to make myself accessible, but I think the thing you find is, as an early stage investor, you probably get more inquiries than any other type of later stage investor. So you have less capital to work with, but you get more inbound requests than anyone. And so really, fighting a battle with email and other types of requests is always, an interesting task. But I do think one thing that's been really cool for me is, and people sort of say this all the time, but you source deals through your network and through people that you know. And part of the reason that I think I use a lot of social networking tools and environments like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and other environments, it allows you to extend your reach in very interesting ways. And there's no way that I can sort of keep up with the level of volume that I think. Most traditional VC firms, the logic is more like they look at 1,000 deals, talk to 100, and do 10 per year. And that's a very volume-intensive review and analysis type of story. And nothing against that approach. I think that definitely yields pretty good results. It's something that your filter is tight. But for me, what the story has really been is I basically have a pretty extensive network of friends who are either engineering types or marketing types or people in product. And in a lot of ways, I use them as a proxy. So my process ends up being I probably don't look at anywhere near 1,000 deals a year. I probably look personally at maybe 100 or so, maybe 200, something like that. But the interesting thing is I would say my extended network probably looks at 10,000 deals a year. And through the process of them recommending and filtering stuff to me, particularly when I get a deal that's recommended from 2 trusted sources, in many cases 3 is the magic number. When I see a deal that's been recommended independently from 3 different people that I know, I sort of wake up and pay attention, and that's. It sounds like a very, sort of passive and uninvolved process, and it's a little strange. But at the same time, I think I'm sort of using the crowd as a way to source deals.
Yeah, you're using social proof in the crowd, yeah. So you're letting your friends who trust vote, and that's a little bit like how Ron Conway does, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's funny that you bring him up. I would say he's one of the people that probably is most adept at using those types of techniques. And, you know, Ron is certainly an amazing guy. I wouldn't say he's innately a technology-focused guy, which is strange to say. I mean, he came out of a sales background at Intel, I believe. Very savvy and smart guy, but I think he's more adept at understanding how people operate than how technology operates necessarily.
He's a guy that doesn't use email, right?
No. He's very fast out with email. I mean, he'll return emails quite quickly, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
So I think people tend to, judge him as being not as technically sophisticated as maybe, the type of other angel investor that you expect. But at the same time, he's savvy in ways that are probably more interesting and more unique than most people would ever come up with. And so, he's pretty much been that, the original person of that technique of being very, very aggressive with lots of small bets. And there are other people I think who sort of emulated that pattern as well. Josh Koppelman at First Round Capital. Paul Graham now with Y Combinator stuff, Jeff Clavier with his fund. A few other people where they've been very nimble and very, I would say, quick to write a small check, and then, continue to follow that up with more effort as the business grows. But I would say, my process is not to have some huge investment thesis and, a bunch of associates who analyze deals and kind of decide, okay, this is the best, most optimal deal. It's really a process of using a trusted network of people that I am familiar with who, have sort of given something a thumbs up and then, it's almost, zen-like in a way that once I've sort of heard a company name from two different people and certainly from three different people, that's when I start to zero in.
Referrals is what you're looking for and multiple referrals from people within your network.
Yeah, and so it's a weird thing to say, get to know someone that I know and convince them that you've got a cool company, but that's certainly part of it. The other thing...
Now you're putting it on me because I know you're leaving, now they're going to beat me up, so that's not fair.
Exactly. It's just impossible to manage the amount of inbound requests that you get. I'm certainly always happy to sit down and, take a look at stuff with people, but,
I'm happy to review stuff too, but obviously most people know when they come and ask some stuff like this, the answer, you've got to check the answer if you know, and maybe we can look at it, maybe there's something there, but,
Well, the answer is never no, it's always a maybe. Or that's interesting, we'll talk to you later, but the thing that really has made a difference for me is that I started doing these talks and presentations around startup metrics, a couple of years ago, in particular, one presentation that I did up in Seattle one time, that was a sort of 5-minute video, that I ended up calling Startup Metrics for Pirates, and a couple of slide presentations. Was really this, 5-step, methodology for analyzing how your different stages of business work and how to, break out the products and marketing efforts into those areas. That's really, two things. One is it's given people a language and a way to sort of talk about their business that I'm already familiar with. And it also gives me a sense that they kind of understand, the perspective that I'm coming at and how I think about, their businesses. And so for a lot of ways, that's kind of given me, an extended presence, on the web for them to say, first thing I talk about when people come to me is like, have you looked at any of my presentations and do you understand what the approach is? If they say no, I say, great, go check out those presentations. If you don't think I'm crazy, then come back to me after you've read them.
Right.
But these days, a lot of people that I talk to, I don't want to say they're regurgitating my, mantras right back at me, but they understand the framework that I laid out, and it just makes it a lot easier and quick to evaluate, how those businesses might operate. And so I think for me, that's actually helped quite a bit in that, again, I may not have as large amount of time as other, firms that are evaluating a lot of stuff. But I tend to see stuff in a framework and a language that I already understand, and they have already sort of put their businesses into that framework.
I've seen you've got those out there, just not looked at them.
Yeah, and then more recently I've done a presentation on how to pitch a VC that is maybe not safe for work consumption, but a lot of people have started to use that as a template pitch deck. And so between Start Metrics for Pirates and that standard how to pitch a VC deck, makes it easier for me to consume, more information quickly from new startups.
Now, we had a funny thing that happened on Facebook, I think it was only a couple of days ago, where you put up a really cute picture of your kids, and one of them was reluctantly giving some cake to the other kid, and you titled it The Reluctant Chair. And it was just a great photo. You got very cute kids, and you could really see that your daughter, she did not want to give that cake to her brother. And then I come along and be a smart ass and write under that, so she's a future VC in training or something. I was laughing my ass off about that. I felt kind of bad about it afterwards, because I know there's a lot of people in your network to see that, but you made an interesting comment responding to that. And I've not worked with investors. I'm interested in your response on that. I mean, there is obviously the term vulture investors, and it can be like a PayPal situation where investors end up making all the money and not the entrepreneurs. What are your thoughts on the reluctant share and the value there, especially in today's environment where things are changing?
Well, I think I can't remember the exact comment I made, but something like, VCs shouldn't be reluctant to that share. They should actually be rather generous about sharing, something like that. I think, I have a maybe different philosophy about, how venture capital is changing and what, that should be, what the philosophy should be. I mean, it's really, people talk about sort of the downturn in financial markets and how that's affected things, and, people sort of presume there's a downturn in the internet market, and I actually am sort of, aggressively optimistic there. I don't really think that much of the, the financial downturn that's happened in mortgage markets and financial services and other areas hasn't really had a huge impact on internet businesses, and the reason I kind of say that is because, you know, for the most part, internet businesses are not capital intensive, and so we don't deal with a lot of debt, which is what caused a lot of problems in, you know, many of the other, you know, more traditional markets. And at the same time, you know, there's a lot of capital already raised. The one thing that I think has been really, you know, a big issue for the VC community is, you know, their limited partners, the people who invest in VC's funds, have had a pretty substantial upheaval in their world. And so, you know, a lot of pension funds and institutions that invest in VCs, you know, have found their net worth or their fund values have gone down by a third, if not more than a third, over the last year. And what that's caused is also, you know, not just a different sort of way to look about, you know, how is venture capital performing, but it sort of changed their asset allocations and also sort of changed, you know, the philosophy about how much risk we should be taking in these other markets. And as a result of that, really I would say we're in quite a bit of upheaval in the VC world where, you know, I don't think it's actually any overstatement to say that maybe one third of the existing VC community today won't be around in 2 or 3 years.
How do you fit into that environment where, I mean, the cost of barrier entry for starting internet companies is so low now?
Right.
Do we need you?
No, I think that actually the point. I mean, I don't think that most VCs are relevant as investors in the internet space. So both things, I don't think there needs to be as much investment in any company. I mean, you know, traditionally, historically, there's maybe been $10, $50 million that you put into companies that might eventually get acquired to go public. And for a lot of, you know, software companies previously where that was, you know, marketing intensive or, you know, production intensive or there were large CapEx costs in, you know, either hardware companies or chip companies, if you contrast that to sort of internet companies these days, you know, certainly the last 5 years, if not 10 years, the cost of a lot of open source software has come down dramatically. You're not paying a lot for database software. You're not paying a lot for web server software, other, you know, almost free or close to free components. And for the most part, your cost structure is really headcount. And to a lesser extent, you know, internet marketing costs for acquisition. But you can build a lot of companies these days for, you know, under $2 to $5 million in capital. You can certainly get the product built for a lot less than that. And so it's actually rather challenging in many ways to put more than $10 million to work for a lot of these internet businesses. And, you know, there's no question there's still a lot of businesses that once they take off do consume and could use more than that. But I think it's really changed how, you know, the VCs are relevant to the startup community. If you look at the way historically VCs were involved, they kind of, you know, at least back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they kind of came out of, you know, the chip and the hardware and software businesses, and people who had been successful there moved into the VC business. And so a lot of cases of people who were VC investors were experienced operators that came out of that industry. An interesting thing happened in the 80s and 90s was they became more...
You know, and Ron Conway totally fits that. He came out of Intel and is an Intel investor. Right. That totally, right. Totally reflects what you're saying.
Right, but in the 80s and 90s, a lot of folks came into the profession that were more traditional, you know, finance and money management folks. They were people who had MBAs. They came out of, you know, the East Coast sort of financial services world. And not to say that that's exclusively the type of folks happened, but they were more about money-based operations and scaling businesses. And so a lot of the expertise that they brought to the table was more in balance sheet sort of restructuring, organizational dynamics and how they would grow the company, sort of looking at how they got the company to, you know, basic level of break-even and profitability. And it was sort of more engineering a company from looking at a spreadsheet or looking at an org chart than it was looking at spec or looking at, you know, sort of a user interface design. And then something interesting happened, which was the internet came along and probably, you know, somewhere around 95, or at least the late 90s, a lot of the customer acquisition methods stopped being enterprise sales focused and stopped being sort of offline marketing campaign focused and started being more about internet distribution via email, via search, via social networks, via viral marketing. And what's really, I think, unique now, I sort of make this statement as one someone who's been a former engineer and developer, the scarce resource and skill set in most internet businesses, while it's certainly important that engineering and programming talent is very important, the scarce resource is really around user interface design and around internet-based marketing skills. And it's strange to say that, but for at least consumer net businesses and maybe businesses that are focused on, you know, small business, long-tail business, the cost of customer acquisition, the techniques of customer acquisition, the costs are down, the techniques are sort of more advanced. And a lot of the ways that companies are either, you know, made or broken have to do with how the customer experiences the product from a user interface standpoint and how many people experience it from an internet marketing standpoint. And the strange thing is when you start having businesses that succeed or fail based on a lot of user interface design and a lot of internet marketing techniques, there's just not that many people who've been around building those businesses who are in the investment community. And it started to change, but, you know, the people who were successful at doing a lot of that internet customer acquisition or search-based acquisition, you know, probably got rich in the late 90s and early 2000s, and some of them started doing a little bit of angel investing, maybe got hurt in the downturn, and a few of them made it into, you know, sort of the professional VC investment community. So what I would argue today is that if you're a startup looking for an investor, you don't need a lot of money, right? And so your angel investor community has magnified itself in, you know, in value. You know, there's a lot more people from the angel investment community that are in the market. There's less capital necessary from the VC community. And more importantly, it's not just the capital that's really, you know, the critical factor for startups to decide, but what types of skills are coming to the table with those investors. And so you see, you know, investors, many investors like, you know, Big Jeff Clave, First Round Capital, and you know, maybe Ron and Baseline and a few others, have all had a lot of experience running these internet marketing businesses. And as a startup, you really, you know, you're probably going to get better terms from the internet, from an angel investor and a small or small VC, and you're going to get better expertise from somebody who's come out of one of these internet marketing businesses.
I'm going to have to jump in because I know you've got a hard stop at the end of this call, and there's an important topic
sure.
we haven't covered yet, and that's geek on a plane. I mean, by the time people are looking at this interview, we're actually going to be on the plane, because I'm flying out from the Caribbean to go out to Japan and China with you. Do you want to talk a little bit about the trip and the ideas behind
sure. it? Sure. Well, and again, I would say this has been more of a, you know, an independent dream of mine, was to get a bunch of people together who are all, you know, sort of geeky and go do a trip to places, you know, that we don't normally get to. My wife is Japanese, and I had the opportunity to go over to Tokyo and visit our family. Our in-laws are there pretty much every year. And that was always really fascinating to me. I got a chance to meet some, you know, startups and entrepreneurs in Tokyo and to see what they were doing. But I've always wanted to travel a little bit more and see, you know, parts of Asia and, you know, eventually hopefully parts of India. In the last year, I've also got to see some places in Europe as well. And so there's all these people who are coming over to the Valley from, you know, their local environment and really coming to the Valley as this kind of mecca place where they get to find out about, you know, how Silicon Valley software startups and internet businesses get run. But I always thought it'd be interesting to go the other way and have people from here sort of go to other, you know, geographies and see what the entrepreneurship culture is like over there, you know, what the funding environments are like, what the, you know, actual successful businesses are like. And so, you know, this whole idea for Geek on a Plane was really almost like traveling roadshow of sorts, where we could talk a little bit about here's the types of businesses and the internet platforms and social networking platforms that have been successful in the States and the funding environment models that come out of Silicon Valley, but also to learn about what's happening in Japan, what's happening in China, and, you know, in the future maybe Korea and other geographies as well, and kind of get a survey of the investment climate, a survey of the startup opportunity and markets, and hear from some successful entrepreneurs, you know, now that I've actually accomplished quite, you know, significant things in those geographies as well. And so it's really more of a cultural exchange opportunity around entrepreneurship and both a great way for us to kind of talk about what happens in Silicon Valley and learn what happens in these other countries, in particular in, you know, sort of the gaming and mobile platforms and maybe social networking platforms. There's a lot of interesting stuff that's been happening out of the Asian geographies and startup businesses there that I think, you know, the U.S. could learn from.
And it looks like you had tremendous response to the trip.
We have. I must say, when I first was getting it together, I would have been happy if we had 5 or 10 people get on board. but we've actually had over 30 people sign up to do it. And, you know, probably if we had a little bit longer, I got a ton of comments from people who said, you know, just a little bit more planning. Notice they would have also come with us. So I think we'll probably end up doing it again. I've already started thinking about doing the trip to Europe in the fall and probably Southeast Asia and India in next spring. But I think
it's going to be an ongoing series. Is it keep on flying all over the place?
I hope so. I mean, I think the thing about a lot of people here is, you know, they might not explore those environments independently, but, you know, within, you know, comfort zone of some other geeks that they're familiar with, and also within the comfort zone of having people on the ground in each of those geographies that they can get to know, I think it becomes a lot more approachable for people to, you know, go out and see places like Beijing and Shanghai and Tokyo that they might not, you know, get to on their own.
And the thing I didn't get, which you kind of helped me understand in an email, is that it's not just going to the places, it's also time on plane. You get to hang out with everyone on plane, too.
Yeah, and I do think we're probably not getting a lot of sleep for this whole trip. but it is probably one of the best, you know, parts of the trip itself. It's just the opportunity to spend traveling with people and really get to know them, you know, in sort of this traveling caravan of greatness. My only regret is we won't have internet access on the plane, at least this time around, but I'm absolutely trying to make sure that happens once we have the next one. So we will be a live traveling blogging social media experiment. You know, it's great. We've gotten support from both TechCrunch and a bunch of other places that are going to help us promote the effort that we're doing. So. My goal is nothing less than to make everyone forget that Robert Scoble ever existed for 10 days.
I don't think that's possible, but maybe we'll achieve it. Anything you want to add in closing?
I guess, you know, a couple of things that we didn't cover that I spent a lot of time on, the startup-to-startup events that I've been putting together for the last year with a few friends, and then also a new effort that we're getting together called Finance for Founders. And both of those are really attempts to kind of use the you know, existing knowledge of the startup community, both in terms of, you know, product and technology ideas, business and marketing ideas, and then maybe, you know, finance and legal structure, and really make that a more regular process for the new folks and the rookies who are building their businesses to get to know each other. You know, one thing about Silicon Valley, it's always been very open, and people are quite willing to share, you know, sort of what's worked with them and what their successes and what their failures have been. But everybody's always been so busy doing their own startups, so I don't know if there's as much of this, you know, structured framework for people to understand more about what's going on there. And I think in the last couple of years, that's starting to, you know, to fill in. A few years back, a guy called Talking Garage, garage.com, was trying to do a lot of things around entrepreneurial education. And then a few other environments that I've been involved with, both Essays and SE Forum had done that. But now I think you've got more professionally focused efforts, sometimes they're investor-driven, where really we're trying to retool and streamline the process of creating businesses. And, you know, I wouldn't say we're scientific by any means yet, but we are trying to get a little bit more regular and sort of rigorous in our products and our process. And so, you know, things like, you know, all the methodology that Eric Ries is talking about with Lean Startup, some techniques that Andrew Shin has talked about on his blog, a few other VCs that I think are really intelligent people who are you know, again, starting to think about how do I optimize the process of building a business. I'm really, those topics are things that I care a lot about and spend a lot of time thinking about. So, you know, with the Startup Venture Pirate Talk and other conferences that we are putting together, it's really around building the craft of entrepreneurship and making that, you know, a business in itself and an education in itself.
Cool. Okay. Well, Dave, thanks very much.
Thanks for your time, Adrian. Thanks for having me.